I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here for Leonard Lopate on this cloudy Monday afternoon. In January of 2007, President George Bush announced a new plan for a strategy in Iraq, which became known as the Surge. Washington Post reporter David Finkel traveled to Iraq with a battalion of Army infantry soldiers of the 216, and he lived with them during their deployment in Baghdad, as well as spent time with their families in Kansas. His book, The Good Soldiers, is a detailed insider's account of the men's experience battling the insurgents in Iraq in 2007 and 2008. It's published by Sarah Crichton Books, and I'm pleased that it has brought the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David Finkel to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
How much time, you know, I said that you spent time in Kansas, and now I'm thinking, did you really? It feels like you were there with the families, but how much time did you spend in Iraq with these men, and did you go to Kansas to see their families?
I did. Kansas, Washington, San Antonio, Texas, but primarily the book was reported in Baghdad. This was a battalion that was on the ground in Baghdad for about 13 months. I think I was with them a little more than 8 months of the time.
How did you decide to write about this particular group of soldiers?
Well, you had mentioned January 2007, and I think it's useful to try to go back for a moment to that period, because we've reached a moment in the war where we're ramping up in Afghanistan. There's a general feeling that perhaps the war in Iraq is over, even though we still have 120,000 soldiers and Marines and troops there. In January 2007, though, if you think back, the war really did seem all but lost. And to any observer or any reader of news, it seemed like what was about to happen next was loss followed by tragedy. At that time, when the surge was announced, there's a guy, a lieutenant colonel named Ralph Koslarich, who was in charge of a battalion of 800 soldiers. Average age 19, most deploying for the first time, most leaving the country for the first time, who had been designated as an infantry battalion in the surge. And when George Bush, explaining this strategy to the nation, said, here are the differences, Koslarich thought to himself, he would be the difference. His soldiers would be the difference. They would be the difference. So off he and his soldiers went, rather naively and optimistically, into this horrible, horrible place in
and
East Baghdad.
How did you know that that's what this battalion leader was thinking? Had you known him before?
I knew. I was there at Fort Riley at the very end of their 2 weeks before they left to go to Baghdad, and got to know him reasonably well during that period. And we had a conversation. He said, if you'd like to see how we're doing perhaps halfway through, why don't you come visit us for another article? I did a first article for the Washington Post. And perhaps you can do another story at the end, because this will probably have some effect on us. And that was enough to make me think that at that point in the war, the great policy books had been done, memoirs had been done, but the simple journalistic act of going and observing and trying to write an intimate portrait of what soldiers go through, at least in this war, had not been done. So I decided to go.
It is such an intimate portrait. As I read it, I felt that I was inside the heads of some of these young soldiers. And as a journalist myself, I wondered, how did you gain their trust? I mean, these were kids. And you're not an old person, but you're not a kid. I mean, how did you get to really get to know these young men and have them trust you enough to tell you these powerful, difficult stories about their lives?
Yeah, it's a good question. And the fact is, it took some time. The lieutenant colonel promised me full access if I could get there. And he was good to his word. I did have a full run to see whatever I wanted to see. Where they went was an area in East Baghdad that was quite violent. It's just the luck of the draw.
Violent and despairing. I mean, and there, with sewage in the streets, it sounded really awful to live there.
It was a pretty rotten place for an Iraqi, and it's a pretty rotten place for an American soldier. I think the trust began to develop very early on when a roadside bomb went off and hit the convoy I was in and dinged up the Humvee I was in, when I guess by their standards I behaved myself. I didn't freak out, but in fact I just chronicled and took notes, and they realized they had someone on their hands who perhaps would be okay. And it developed over time.
Had you ever had experiences like that before?
Well, yes and no. As a reporter at the Post, I've covered wars in Kosovo, Afghanistan, and the beginning of the Iraq War. I thought I was ready for this, but nothing prepared me for what this place was like.
I felt that in the book. You know, you don't figure at all as a persona in the book, but it seems that most of these men really were not prepared either for what they were going to encounter.
You know, in the end, I don't know how you could prepare for it, no matter how much training you have. Again, this part of Baghdad, it was a Shiite area. It had been pretty well cleansed at that point in the war. And in West Baghdad, a Sunni area, and where there was more al-Qaeda, the weapon of choice really was kind of a suicide bombing and some snipers. In this area, the weapon of choice was a particular type of roadside bomb called an EFP. And if I can take a minute and explain
it. Yes, please.
It's a really insidious thing. It's basically a 6 or an 8 or a 10-inch copper disc that's placed over a tube filled with explosives. And when someone pushes a button or pushes a trigger as a convoy passes and this copper disc discharges, it's at such a high rate of speed, it becomes semi-molten very quickly. And what happens is it just basically burns through whatever is in front of it, whether it's a person, whether it's the thickest, best Humvee in the U.S. Army, or whether it's a soldier inside the Humvee. Happened again and again and again. And these things were just impossible to detect because they were hidden. They were hidden in pieces of curbing, pieces of block to look like a curb, or they were hidden in walls, or they were hidden in animal carcasses, or under piles of trash. And trash was everywhere in eastern Baghdad. So to go out in this area, you simply couldn't prepare for it, except, it was an interesting thing. The soldiers would, over time, as their optimism began to fade and their naivete faded, they would begin to do kind of calculations about how to survive the day's patrol. And it was in the most piercing, simplest things you can imagine. A soldier would get in a Humvee, and he might sit with one foot in front of another. So if the EFP came into the Humvee, he would lose one foot instead of two. He would tuck his hands behind his ceramic vest. He would lean away from the door just a little bit to increase the area where it came in. And again, this was the deal. Out they went every day, knowing these things were out there, and they were out there.
And knowing that some of their comrades had been killed or terribly, terribly injured by these.
Knowing it because they had seen it and because they became witnesses too.
You write very harrowingly about some of these attacks and about the dead and the injured. Was this from your own witnessing these things happening, or were these stories that you heard afterwards when the soldiers came back?
Both. Primarily, everything in the book is an observed piece of journalism. I'm most comfortable when I'm there seeing something for myself. In some cases, I had the luxury of every couple of months leaving, getting my breath, either going to the Washington Post Bureau in another part of Baghdad and just taking a few days and having a glass of wine, or coming back to the States and doing a little reporting. The soldiers didn't have that luxury and kept going out every day, of course, and you could see the cumulative effect over time. So when I say most of it was observed, it's because I was there with them, among them, for the majority of the deployment. But there were periods when I was back in the States as well.
There's one attack where the soldiers actually see what could have been a trigger, a kind of wire that they think may have gone to where this EFP was fired from. And this leader goes to follow it. Can you tell us about what happened?
Oh,
then?
Sure. It was an awful day. There were some buried explosives, actually, and when a Humvee ran over it and somebody pushed the trigger at the right moment, Humvee went, I don't know, most accounts had it going at least 5-10 feet in the air, coming down on fire. Five soldiers inside, four survived, one no one could get to him, so he burned to death in the Humvee. One of the soldiers saw a red wire, a skinny red wire, running off into the trees, really. And maybe he should have seen it. He didn't know. Maybe he should have seen it before, because this was a rather dusty environment, and it was, once you notice it, red couldn't be any brighter than it was when he saw it. But it was buried, it was hidden, and when they found the wire, even as the Humvee remained on fire and their friend and the fellow soldier was burning inside, they traced the wire through the trees to a house where they ran inside and found a man cowering in a corner. And as he turned and faced them with a gun, they shot him. And one of the soldiers involved in the shooting, a very good soldier named Jay March, it was the first time he had killed someone in his life. And I remember a few days later, when the whole platoon was pretty shell-shocked by what had happened, spending a lot of time talking to Jay March about what it was like to kill someone for the first time.
And was that where there was also a little girl in the room, too?
There was, yes. When he went in the room, after he shot this man in the head and saw him falling, he detected a motion in the corner, and he looked, and there was a girl in the arms of her mother, just looking at him, and he thought, my God, I've just killed somebody, and this little girl just saw me kill somebody, and that's the way it's going to be for her. He was the one so terribly haunted by it. Days later, he just could not. It wasn't just shooting someone in the head that he couldn't get out of his mind. It was a little girl seeing him as well.
And that incident sort of brought so many different things together, both the physical, the death and the maiming and the destruction that was physically wrought on these soldiers, and then also the emotional and mental toll that this work exacted from them.
I think that's right, and you could see it develop month by month by month as the deployment continued. This, again, they happened to draw a pretty tough area, and as the bombs kept going off and as there were snipers hitting soldiers, despite soldiers trying their hardest to do everything they were trained to do, it did have an effect, and well, it was hard not to sense a change in attitude until, you know, at the end. The fact is, at the end, after 13, almost 14 months on the ground, they thought they had made a difference because violence was down. They had rounded insurgents up. They were arrested. The streets seemed a bit quieter. And then, as they were packing up to leave, their deployment over, something happened that was so ruinous and heroic at the same time that's finally what broke every bit of illusion they might have had.
I'm speaking with David Finkel. He's written a book called The Good Soldiers. It's from Sarah Crichton Books. When you took on this assignment, it sounds like you had a sense of the kind of book you wanted to write.
I did, in the sense that, yes, I wanted to write a book, an intimate look at what happens to soldiers. I had no idea what was going to happen. I took a leave from the post. I went over to Baghdad. It took a little while to get there because it took perhaps 6 weeks to arrange disability insurance. But once that was arranged, then I left and caught up with these guys in Baghdad. And it was right after they had their first death in the battalion. And then day by day, week after week, just when you thought things couldn't get any worse, things did get worse. And so I found myself in a place where after a few weeks and a few rocket attacks and a few mortar attacks, I really began understanding why journalists hadn't done this before. But by that time, I was invested. I wanted to see what happened to these guys.
We have to take a quick break. I'm speaking with Washington Post reporter David Finkel about his book, Good Soldiers. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and we'll be back in a moment. Don't forget to send in your commute stories. Tell us your funny, strange, or inspiring experience on the trains, subways, buses, or sidewalks of New York in 300 words or less. For more information about how to enter, visit our show page. But you have to hurry. The deadline is this Wednesday, October 14th. I'm Julie Burstein. I'm in today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.
WNYC support comes from the Silver Palette, makers of various gourmet food products, including Silver Palette Thick and Rough Oatmeal, textured oatmeal made with 100% whole grain milled oats, no salt, sugar, or fat added. More information available at silverpalette.com. Movers, not shakers. Residential and commercial movers, changing the way New Yorkers feel about movers. With environmentally sustainable practices, biodiesel fuels, and reusable bins, 718-243-0221 or at moversnotshakers.com.
The WNYC Community Advisory Board invites you to a forum about how economic issues are covered in the media. All are welcome. Thursday night at 7 at the New York Society for Ethical Culture, 2 West 64th Street. Details at WNYC.org.
Here comes the bride. There goes tradition. Today on Soundcheck, how Def Leppard and Etta James are replacing standards like Pachelbel's Canon at weddings. Plus, a music critic and a bride-to-be share the best and worst wedding music. That's coming up at 2 on 93.9 FM WNYC. I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here for Leonard Lopate on this Monday afternoon, and I'm speaking with David Finkel, who is a Washington Post reporter and the author of The Good Soldiers from Sarah Crichton Books. David, this was a group of how many hundred soldiers was it?
800.
800 soldiers. Mm-hmm. You talked a little bit about Jay March, who's one of the soldiers that you write about quite a bit. How did you find the soldiers that you wanted to portray?
I like that question. That's interesting. Lieutenant Colonel Koslerich was an obvious choice for a character because it was his battalion. There and other characters in the book developed as events unfolded. I didn't go over with the set cast of characters to see what would happen to them, but depending what happened, that's how I would meet and concentrate on various soldiers and also some Iraqis as well. I did my best to get some Iraqi voices in the book as well, because that's, I think, one of the things that's been missing from the literature about the war. So characters in the book would include Lieutenant Colonel Koslerich. There's a guy named Brent Cummings, Major Cummings, who in many ways is the moral voice of the book, is someone who I found to be so decent and compassionate, and trying to conduct a horrific war in the most moral and humane way possible, if that makes sense.
At the beginning of the book, we meet him when he's trying to figure out how to bury an Iraqi who had been killed, decapitated, and put in a sewage facility.
Yes, yes. And most people wouldn't even give it a second thought, but he was trying to figure out how in the world do you get a cadaver out of this bit of sewage and do the decent thing. By the end of the book, after seeing what he had seen, Brent Cummings, still trying to be a moral voice, it was much cloudier, the man he had become. There is there's an interpreter named Izzy, who, he's an Iraqi national, had been to America once and loved America so much that wherever he went, one of the things he carried was a frequent flyer card from Pan American Airways, even though that airway no longer existed. There is another interpreter, a young woman named Rachel. That was the name she went by because all the interpreters had fake names, who had been in 40 explosions while she tried to be an interpreter for the U.S. Army and had the unique, awful experience of knowing what it's like to have your blood filling up with the boots of a soldier as you try to rescue him while he's dying. There is a soldier named Duncan Crookston who was in a Humvee that was hit by an EFP on September 4th, 2007. Three soldiers died immediately. A fourth lost both his legs, and Duncan lost both legs at his hips, his right arm at his shoulder, and his left arm about halfway up, and everything that was left of him was burned quite badly.
And his eyelids and his nose and his ears he lost.
Lost his ears, lost his eyelids. At one point, what remained of his eyes had to be sutured while he was in the hospital because of infection. Somehow, several months later, he was still alive in San Antonio, Texas, when the book's main character, Lieutenant Colonel Koslerich, was on leave, and he went to San Antonio to visit Duncan and his family.
Did you go with him?
Sure. Yeah.
That's one of the most harrowing moments in the book, is when he walks in and sees this young soldier's 19-year-old wife and mother trying to care for this man who has been so badly injured.
Well, sure. And then seeing what was left of his soldier. This is half a body pretty much bolted to a bed, wrapped in bandages, except for what was left of his eyes. They were covered by goggles, and the goggles were self-misting goggles because he didn't have the ability to produce tears anymore. So whatever came into his view was basically swimming into view through these droplets of water. And here one day came his commander, Lieutenant Colonel Koslerich, to say things to him and to give him a couple of medals and then to wander on. And Koslerich is I think, one of the strongest, most optimistic people I've met.
He often said, and you write this, it's all good.
It's all good.
Even after soldiers were killed, it was, you know, there was a disconnect there that from a distance seemed just so powerful, but it also seemed like it gave hope to his soldiers.
Well, when he walked into Duncan Crookston's room, he didn't say it's all good. He just saw him for the first time and said very quietly to himself, damn, and then walked over and did the best he could.
Mm.
Went back to Iraq, after that visit, and a couple days later came an email from Duncan's mother saying he had died.
I read your book sitting on my porch in my leafy suburb looking out at the sunshine this weekend. And, you know, I mentioned disconnect, feeling the tremendous disconnect that we have here where we're so fortunate. And then reading about Izzy, this interpreter, whose house was destroyed, whose daughter was gravely injured, who was able, through the good ministrations of Brent Cummings, to have his daughter cared for on the base,
mm-hmm.
and thought it. I wasn't sure what to think. It just feels so distant, and yet it's, a book like yours brings it so powerfully, vividly to life.
Well, there. One thing I tried to do in the book is not make it a political book in any way. There's really no. The only promise I made to the soldiers is that I would try to write a book about what was happening to them without any agenda whatsoever, and I hope I succeeded at that. What would happen to me is much like you're describing. Every time I would leave Baghdad and come back to the States, it's almost like there were two wars, if that makes sense. There was the war that was being fought over there, which is all anyone could think about. War was basically another Humvee blowing up on route predators and three soldiers dead inside. And you get on a plane, take a helicopter out of the base I was on, get on a plane to Jordan, and eventually I would find my way back to the United States, to Washington, D.C., where I live. It was just a totally different war. It was all about politics and about strategy, and it was... You know, maybe that's the way wars have to be fought, in these two different ways. The one I was more interested in, though, was the one over there, the more observed, intimate war.
I'm speaking with David Finkel. His book is called The Good Soldiers. It's from Sarah Crichton Books, and it's about a battalion of soldiers who were there during the surge. That contrast comes very clear when David Petraeus visits this battalion. And you write about the lieutenant colonel thinking about, what is he going to tell David Petraeus? Is he going to tell him that things are getting better, or is he going to tell him about the soldiers that he's lost and the horror that he's seen?
And what he ended up doing was telling General Petraeus about all the good things his battalion was accomplishing, including an operation that was known as Operation Benzene. It was basically to put a platoon of soldiers at a gas station across from the base. And that simple act resulted in gas lines going from 2 days down to 20, 15 minutes. And it also dried up a lot of the funding source of the insurgency that was resulting in these EFPs exploding soldiers. So he talked about that, and Petraeus said, you know, we've heard about that, and we need to do this all over Baghdad. And for Koslerich, it really was one of the finer moments of his soldiering life that this very important, celebrated man and soldier had complimented him. And David Petraeus left, and a couple of hours later, Koslerich was standing outside, just exulting in this. It was about the happiest I had seen him, when there was an explosion and a coil of smoke in the air coming from the gas station across from the base, and an EFP had gone off, and it had hurt a soldier terribly, and the soldier was brought to the aid station, and Kosarich stood by and watched another soldier dying in front of his eyes. You know, it's the kind of thing that if this, I don't know, I think sometimes if this book were a work of fiction, it would be criticized for being so contrived. But in fact, it's what happened. The things that happened were just beyond belief, and yet they happened not just to this battalion, to every battalion. And I'm not a reporter who makes assumptions or works from assumptions, but I think it's fair to say that the story in this book is the story of pretty much any battalion in the surge or any battalion in any war. It's not new that war is bad, but in the details of this might be some lessons about what we're really doing when we're sending more troops into Afghanistan and continuing our presence in Iraq.
And there's a Sisyphean quality. There's a kind of quality. One soldier says it's like Groundhog Day. Every morning I wake up and I have to do the same thing over again.
It did feel that way. And you know, it had an effect on me at the beginning. I would get in a Humvee almost every day and go out eagerly. Part of the best reporting is it involves serendipity. You just go out and see what happens. By the end, after 8 months there and so many rocket and mortar attacks and seeing the effects of VFPs and being in a few explosions, it was very difficult for me to go out. And that concerned me as a journalist, but I had just reached a point where I couldn't go out very often. And I was doing the same things, leaning away from doors, lining up my feet, the rest of it. The difference is I could get away from it. The soldiers couldn't. They went out every day, and I have to say, by the end, the small act of them getting in a Humvee to go out yet again was just the very definition of bravery to me.
You write at the end of the book about something that almost, if it weren't so awful, it would be comic relief, which is some of the soldiers, including Jay March, going for, I can't remember the name of it, but it was going up in front of some sort of commission to try to receive Soldier of the Month, I guess it was.
That's
and
exactly right.
There is just this, you know, they get thrown out for having their pressure bandages outside of the wrappings, even
That's
though,
right.
as one of the soldiers said, if you have it in the wrapping, it takes another 10 seconds to unroll it, and you need it, so you want it outside the wrapping. That, I found, one of the most, the saddest parts of the book.
Well, in some ways, I was grateful for that competition because, at least in my notes, this thing had become so relentlessly difficult, I thought, to actually transcribe this and try to chronicle it in a way that a reader would be interested. At some point, there's got to be a break. You have to take a breath, just like I could as a reporter. And so the Soldier of the Month board seemed to offer this opportunity. And it was, you know, like so many things, it was just funny and absurd and heartbreaking at the same time.
We just have about a minute left. But for you, you know, you write about the soldiers coming home and how difficult it was for them. What was it like for you after all these months in Iraq to come home to your own family?
Well, it was easy for me because I got to sit down for a year and write the book. And I think that was quite cathartic. For the soldiers, they didn't quite know what to do with this experience. And they had a very difficult time talking about it. And one of the best things since the publication of the book a couple of weeks ago, I'm getting lots of emails from these soldiers saying, finally, we still can't talk about it, but now we have a book we can hand to people and say, if you read this, you'll get some sense of what it was like.
Thank you so much for being here. David Finkel is the author of The Good Soldiers. It's from Sarah Crichton Books. And David will also be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at the Half King at 505 West 23rd Street. You're also writing for the Washington Post. We have just a second left. What are you writing about now?
Oh, I'm not writing very much. I've taken to editing for a little while I just sort of get the book finally out of my system.
Well, thank you for joining us today to talk about these soldiers who are human beings, and we can see that in this book.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Tomorrow, Leonard will be back, and he'll be joined by Peter Gelb, the general manager of the Metropolitan Opera, and Margaret Juntwaite, the voice of the Met, during the afternoon Saturday radio broadcasts. And they'll tell us about the upcoming season there. Then Ivanka Trump on what she's learned from her father, the Donald. Also, Karen Armstrong makes a case for God and explains why religion has been so important to people from the Paleolithic age to the present. Plus, historian Anthony Beaver, who's the first major account of D-Day in over 20 years. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Miranda Schaefer, Stephanie Bernhard, and Adam Delahunty. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Julie Burstein. Thanks so much for listening, and enjoy the rest of this day.